Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Gentrification. We all know what that is, right? Younger, whiter artist types move into older, browner, poor, and working class neighborhoods, drawn there by space, light, and cheap rents. They bring services and stability, and the next thing you know, there's a bank on one corner, the Gap on the other, and the old timers and the artists can't afford to live there anymore. But what about traditionally black neighborhoods like Harlem, Clinton Hill, Bed-Stuy, where it's just as likely these days to be young professional African-Americans doing the gentrifying? Does that change the process or the ethics? Those are some of the questions that Mary Petillo explores in her book Black on the Block, The Politics of Race and Class in the City. She's a professor of sociology and African-American studies at Northwestern University in Chicago, and she joins us now. Welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Thank you for having me.
You're a sociologist at Northwestern, but your interest in this is also personal. So can you talk about how these roles of researcher and participant mixed in your study of a particular neighborhood on Chicago's South Side?
Right. So when I first started doing this research on the North Kenwood Oakland neighborhood here in Chicago, I was really just an observer. So we like to call ourselves participant observers. And I started off as just an observer, and I'd go to community meetings and I'd talk to my neighbors. I moved into the neighborhood and I took a lot of field notes. But after about 2 years of really just observing and trying not to impact the neighborhood too much, I became a member of what's called the Conservation Community Council, or basically it's the mayoral and aldermanically appointed body that oversees all new development in the North Kenwood Oakland neighborhood. It's actually mandated by a state law. The neighborhood was deemed a conservation area, and this Conservation Community Council is what oversees new development. So then I really became a participant and somebody who had to vote every month on a new plan, on new housing plans, on new commercial infrastructure, on new aesthetic developments that would happen in the neighborhood. And so I very much became a participant then. And it really, I think, was a very much a learning experience. As a sociologist, we like to study things. But when we really have to take a stand and make a vote, it, I think, helps to understand the complexity of the politics and the kinds of hard decisions that people have to make in neighborhoods that are changing like this, because they have many competing interests and competing philosophies.
So what was the question you most wanted to answer in writing this book that overlapped with your personal experience?
The question I wanted to answer was if black gentrification looks any different from white gentrification. And so the study wasn't a comparative study, meaning I didn't study a neighborhood where whites were moving into a poor neighborhood or a neighborhood where people of color lived. But there's lots of literature out there on that. So I could pretty much compare what I was finding where I was studying to the existing literature, loads of literature on gentrification when whites move in. And so I was interested in finding what looks different. And I found a number of things. One thing that looks very different is many of the African Americans who are moving into places like North Kenwood, Oakland, and as you mentioned, like in Harlem and Fort Greene and so on, are not coming from neighborhoods too dissimilar from those places, meaning some of the people who moved into the neighborhood I studied had grown up there as young children, had moved out as they were upwardly mobile, and now saw this neighborhood as a place that they could come back and contribute to.
Rather than just escape from.
Exactly. So they very much saw themselves as part of a renaissance of people who had a familiarity with this neighborhood, who had roots in this neighborhood. And that's really why I'm playing on the idea, Quincy Jones's song, Back on the Block, that many people are really coming back on the block as opposed to this being a foreign territory. You know, we hear the word urban pioneer so much, and pioneers go places where no man or no woman have gone before. And the people who are moving into many of these neighborhoods are people who have been there before, or at least been in areas very much like it.
So do you find that the effects of black-on-black gentrification, if you will, are any different than when whites move in?
I think some of the effects are very similar, meaning you can't help the fact that housing prices go up, rents go up as a result, and as a result, fewer and fewer people are able to buy into such a neighborhood, and some of the renters, as their rents go up, have to move out. There have been lots of debates in the social science literature on if gentrification causes displacement. And what has been found is the poor people who live there want to stay, and they actually are less mobile than poor people in other kinds of neighborhoods. And so they stay. But when they do move, as low-income households are likely to do for many reasons, when they do move, their unit no longer is available for another low-income person because that now it goes kind of on the competitive market and higher income people are more likely to move in. So it's not so much that people are being pushed out as the new units that come available are more likely to go to higher income people.
But people people are also pushed out, right? Because landlords in rental units realize that they can make much more rent than they're currently getting. So they raise the rent as the market value goes up and the poorer people can't afford to pay the rent. And don't they get pushed out that way?
I've definitely observed that and documented that in my book, but ethnography, the kind of method I use, is not well suited to look at that on a broad scale. So when we look at some of the larger housing studies on gentrification and displacement, they don't find as much of that because there's also that going on even in low-income neighborhoods, meaning landlords, for whatever reason, are either neglecting people move out because of neglect or they are sometimes changing rent structures. So low-income populations are very mobile, and they try to stay in gentrifying neighborhoods even more so than in poor neighborhoods because of the growing amenities in those neighborhoods. Now, again, I am not at all saying that I don't have cases in my book where exactly what you describe happened, where the landlord, for whatever reasons, wanted to get out of family. I have one example in particular where a young woman and her children, she liked to stand in front of the building with her friends, and her children liked to play out in front of the building, and the landlord was starting to get complaints from the new condo owners next door, and she, you know, wasn't going to mind what he wanted, and he had the last word. He raised the security deposit and the rent, and they couldn't meet what were the new demands, and they had to move. So surely I have examples of exactly that.
We're talking about gentrification of black neighborhoods when the gentrifiers themselves are black, with Mary Petillo from Chicago and Northwestern University and the author of the book Black on the Block, The Politics of Race and Class in the City. And listeners, when talking about gentrification, does race matter to you? Let's hear from you. If you live in Bed-Stuy or Clinton Hill or Harlem, wherever, longtime residents or newcomers, where are the fault lines? How do the power struggles play out in your neighborhood? Does race matter? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Do you think a difference between black gentrification and white gentrification is one of intent?
Right. So I think what I was, you know, the first part about people moving back on the blocks is about an intent to participate in a renaissance rather than a more narrow focus on here I can get a lower priced house in a good location, which I think is more the motivation of white gentrifiers. It's more an economic motivation, whereas I think for black gentrifiers, the motivation is both economic and kind of sociocultural, an attempt to rejuvenate a neighborhood, to participate in the in a kind of self-help mission, a kind of racial collectivist mission around improving a black neighborhood. And in many ways, improving a black neighborhood and keeping it black. I mean, while many people in the neighborhood that I studied said they would be fine with some racial integration, nobody wanted the neighborhood to be majority white. Most people wanted the neighborhood to remain majority black and to have a really black cultural feel. As a result, a lot of the institutions that are moving into the neighborhood, things like what's called Little Black Pearl Workshop, which is a youth arts organization, Muntu Dance Theater, which is an African dance organization, a lot of the cultural institutions that are wanting to really root themselves in this neighborhood are about celebrating black culture.
You know, I got the idea from the book that you were disappointed by the lack of solidarity to hear Bill Cosby-like pronouncements, if you want to call it that, from your fellow middle-class residents toward the working class and public housing residents. Is that how you felt?
Well, if you heard some disappointment in the book, that was probably a little kind of normative evaluation coming out on my part, which is not really the thrust
that's
of
what
the book.
That's what a sociologist calls feelings, normative
exactly,
evaluation.
Exactly right. We try to avoid feelings, but if it came out, you saw a little bit of me in there. But what the argument I was trying to make is that the Black community has always had these internal debates. In 1957, E. Franklin Frazier wrote a book called The Black Bourgeoisie, which was a scathing indictment of the Black middle class, actually, that they were soulless and that they had lost their rooting in the Black community. But at the same time that he was, really tearing apart the Black middle class, Black middle class folk were tearing apart the Black poor. In the North, in northern cities, in New York and in Chicago, people just ridiculed nonstop the Southern migrants who continued to come. They thought they were filthy and that they didn't know how to act and they didn't know how to keep their yards and they were bringing their backward Southern ways. So these kinds of debates in the Black community have been ongoing. And the point I'm trying to make in Black on the Block is that these debates is actually what constitutes the Black community. As I argue, when Bill Cosby no longer has anything to say about how he thinks poor African Americans should raise their kids, and when the Black folk who have moved back to North Kenwood, Oakland, and are moving back to Harlem no longer want to move to places like that and participate in a community uplift project, when those folks no longer care, then we can talk about the demise of the Black community and that there is no longer solidarity. But I think that this continued participation, even when that participation includes bitter debates, is what constitutes the Black community.
Let's take a phone call. Naomi in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Naomi.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I welcome this conversation because I was I relocated to Jersey City to help convert some buildings into condos, and when that didn't happen, I took great issue with the community that I was living in because it's a beautiful community. It has a beautiful 9.25-acre park, and it's swarming with tons of potential. And I was met with resentment from Black residents who I took issue with, who didn't want to keep their property clean, who didn't pick up after their dog. They walked their dog along the park. I lived in Midtown for 10 years. I constantly picked up after my dog. And it's not because I lived around white folks. It's because I was brought up by a very Southern Black mother and father who taught us the value of community. We live here, clean it, keep it beautiful. I don't care if it's a shack. You keep it clean. It's a reflection of you and your community. And those values are not being taught. I don't understand why. It has nothing to do with color. It really has a lot to do with class.
So, Professor Patillo, this is classic to what you found in your book, right?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I totally agree that this is not just an issue of race. It's, in fact, because I'm in many ways holding race constant, meaning these are all African Americans, it's all having to do with class in many instances. I think the caller definitely points to a common thread in some of the complaints about a loss of desire to keep up property. I would add, though, what I try to really play up in this book is two things. One is that much of what we attribute to bad values is actually a reflection of people being poor. So there's no question that somebody can pick up their their potato chip bag after not throw it on the ground. That's easy. But some of the things that we attribute to, for example, home upkeep. First of all, a number of the people in the neighborhood are renters, and it's really the landlord who's not keeping up a building. But even in people who own their homes, senior citizens on fixed incomes or low-income folks who might have inherited their homes, as we all know, it takes a lot to keep up with all of the tiny, both cosmetic and structural things that happen in a house, the cracked front steps, the peeling paint, the tarnished gate, the broken handle on a gate. And these things are a matter really of having the economic wherewithal to keep up with these little things. It's not about values.
Naomi, did you want to say something else?
I kind of disagree with that on two fronts. First, there's also a mindset with people within the community that police the community, also like the police officers who don't want to impose, like I called them many times about watering. I don't want you sitting outside drinking or doing whatever because you don't live here. And even if you did, you rented the inside of your unit, not the exterior. That was met with great resentment from both black and white officers. In terms of upkeep, we have 99-cent stores, dollar stores. How difficult is it to replace, you know, a light plate or a knob? It really is the responsibility of the landlord, but you live there. It is your home that you walk in and out of. And what I resent, the people that claim, you know, that pose this argument about, well, it's not my home, you know, the upkeep is so enormous. They're wearing $300 and $400 bags, wearing $600, you know, jeans, and constantly contributing to these European designers, you know, bottom line. But the bottom line is you live in a home that's a reflection of something. Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess I would comment on two fronts. One, on the loitering issue. You know, one person's, I think I have an exact story to that. The woman lived in the building. She liked standing outside. I think, again, we have to think economics. Many people live in situations, in overcrowded housing situations. In the summertime, for example, those of us who have air conditioning would prefer to probably sit in the air conditioning as opposed to sitting outside. You know, there are lots of reasons why people stand outside, in addition to just appreciating outside sociability and having a larger group than just your nuclear family, perhaps, inside. And I think we actually have to raise our tolerance level for different people's choices for how they're going to use public space. I'm not arguing we need to raise our tolerance level to include sexual harassment or violence against folks or that kind of thing, but different people's uses of space that is really very much occasioned on the kind of inside and outside resources that people have. On the second issue about how much does it cost to replace a light plate, you know, for low-income families that are really juggling everything from food and paying the utilities and clothing folks, New York is the place where knockoffs reign supreme, right? Mm-hmm. My guess is that they are not buying the actual $600 bag. Mm-hmm. And you know, in fact, are bargaining and budgeting to afford both clothes and home upkeep.
Naomi, thank you very much for your call. I don't think we're going to be able to resolve this all here today, but you've certainly laid out what's going on for you in Jersey City. And when we continue in a minute, before we take some of our other many other callers, Professor Patillo, I'm going to ask you if you have seen any more success than Naomi and her neighbors are apparently having with each other in navigating this divide. If there's a way that people can come together around these class values or whatever they are during the gentrification of black neighborhoods. But we will continue with Mary Patillo, Professor Patillo, sociologist at Northwestern University, author of Black on the Block, The Politics of Race and Class in the City, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We continue now with sociologist Mary Patillo from Northwestern University. Her book is called Black on the Block, The Politics of Race and Class in the City. It's about her study of what happens when middle-class African-Americans gentrify traditionally low-income African-American neighborhoods, how it's similar and different to when white people come in and gentrify. Some of it relates to her own experience as somebody who has moved into a gentrifying neighborhood. And that question that I mentioned before the break, you could hear the frustration in Naomi's voice from Jersey mm-hmm. City, and it sounds like her neighbors are probably just as frustrated with her. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have you seen any examples in your study of successful attempts to navigate that divide?
I think that's a great question. And there might be small-scale examples, for example, planning a block club party. And, you know, so these are small, like on one block, and deciding about entertainment and what activities there'll be for our children and those kinds of things where, so for example, in one case, one of the people who lived on the block wanted a car wash at their block club party. The old timers did. And one of the newcomers was like, I don't want a car wash. You know, that's commerce. This is supposed to be, you know, a fun time. But that some of the low-income residents saw having a car wash during the Black Club Party as a way to make some money, because, you know, there are lots of ways to make ends meet. And ultimately, the middle-class person relented and saw that this had to be a community effort and that there were lots of different opinions about what a Black Club Party might include. So there are some small examples like that. But I also want to say that, you know, what's going on in gentrifying neighborhoods is not too dissimilar from what goes on in all kinds of communities. There's always, even in very middle-income communities, you know, one neighbor will lament how the other neighbor didn't put the stuff on the grass so that they didn't have dandelions or didn't paint their fence. Those are very, I think, much less volatile. And I think in gentrifying neighborhoods, it's much more volatile because mm-hmm. the inequality is much more severe and it's a much more dynamic situation. I also want to say that I hear Naomi. I don't want to. The reason I push back is because I think we have much rhetoric in the public sphere around the bad behaviors of poor people, and we never push against the possibility of raising the tolerance of middle-class folk to accept some of those behaviors. And so I'm constantly pushing against that while I do admit that there are ways in which poor folks should learn to live in a mixed-income community as well.
Danny in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Danny.
Hello. Great subject. I think the main issue is whether low-income, white or black, are going to be allowed to live in cities at all. And I think that the middle-class blacks are facilitating the realtors pushing low-income blacks out of the city. And once that process is gone, as with the artists in Tribeca and Soho, the middle-class blacks will be themselves displaced by higher-income whites. When these people move into the area, it doesn't feel any better to be displaced by a black person than a white person. I mean, early on she said that she was studying gentrification, but if you're moving into the neighborhood, you're not studying. You're a participant in the process. The people that move in, they have that Bill Cosby syndrome, hostile at the lower income population and what they perceive to be their values. Instead of the middle class working with their black brothers to confront the white power structure, they work with the white power structure to demobilize the black lower class.
You and Naomi should go to dinner.
Yes, we should.
Well, no, actually, I think that you and Naomi actually are on different sides because
that's
this
what I
gentleman
mean.
Is. Oh, right, exactly.
That's right. Absolutely.
Right,
that's
right.
I like to get people who are different together for dinner, but
yes,
maybe that's just
you.
Me.
I got you. And so then I would, if I were at that dinner, try to mediate a bit. So let me say, I have a chapter in this book called White Power, Black Brokers. And in many respects, I agree with exactly what you're saying. Let me also say that in that chapter, I have a whole section on my own role. I put forth this idea that black middle class newcomers in these neighborhoods are what I call middlemen and middle women or brokers. And I think I agree totally with you. And I interrogate my own role as a middleman, as someone who paid 40% more for her house than the person who bought it, who as a result has raised the home prices in the neighborhood. And what I try to say is that these middlemen and these brokers are exactly that. Sometimes you're right. They're doing the bidding of the white power structure or of white civic elites or white developers. But other times they very much do the bidding and are in allegiance with and alliances with black poor residents.
Just briefly, my last mm-hmm. comment, you very rarely see middle-class blacks have any association with the lower-income residents in their community.
Well, that's not the case in this particular neighborhood. Middle-class blacks have been adamant that the new construction projects have to have black workers and they want them to be local workers, that the new grocery store that went in the neighborhood, and they were vigilant in policing this, had community employment. They have been vigilant around bringing mortgage capital to the neighborhood, which benefits low-income homeowners. So I think that there are many associations. And in fact, actually, I mean, I hear a lot of people lamenting, as I said before, that middle class black folk don't have anything to do with low income black folk. But there are lots of people who are, you know, in community organizations and running tutoring programs. And there's one gentleman who runs a ping pong program, for an after school program for youth in the neighborhood. Lots of people are very, very involved. And that's why I really emphasize this role as middlemen. It's not all one, you know, siding with one side or the other. As I say, it's not siding with the man or siding with the little man always. It's really this kind of oscillating, pivotal role right there in the middle.
This middle, and Danny, thanks for your call. This middleman, or you call it middleness, in the book, the role of the middle class in intervening with the white power structure. Can you go a little bit more into that? And do they risk patronizing? I mean, maybe the poor and working class folks are better at organizing on their own today to intervene with the white power structure.
Yes. I mean, excellent point. In fact, what we see in national survey data is that 79% of middle class blacks feel like they have a responsibility to help poor African Americans. So the sense of responsibility and allegiance and linked fate is there. But when you ask the question, do you think you understand the situation of poor blacks? Middle class black folk think that they understand the situation of poor blacks much better than poor blacks think middle class black folk understand their situation. Mm-hmm. So I think you're exactly right that this this uplift mentality can sometimes be patronizing, and I think it sometimes sits on some of the comments that Naomi was making. You know, we have an understanding that people shouldn't be loitering, that people shouldn't be doing a car wash, people shouldn't be fixing cars on the street, people shouldn't be doing this and doing that, whereas oftentimes what low-income people want is a safe place to live, but also a place where they can use public space in ways that are comfortable for them, in ways that they've been using it for many years, in ways that aren't, you know, necessarily hurting anyone else if someone else's tolerance is raised. So I think you are one of the biggest arguments in this neighborhood is around public housing, where the middle-class newcomers wanted to demolish public housing and really decrease the numbers of public housing units. Mm-hmm. And the public housing residents, of course, that was not in their interest. And they very much wanted to be a part of this neighborhood's renaissance. Just as the neighborhood is improving, they were seeing the numbers of their units go down. And they didn't see that in their interest at all. And that was a huge debate.
We have a few minutes left with Mary Petillo from Northwestern University, author of Black on the Block, The Politics of Race and Class in the City. Monique in Clinton Hill, you're on WNYC. Hi, Monique.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I live in Clinton Hill, and I moved there a few years ago just when it started to get the renaissance going. And what I like about the community is that there's a combination of different cultures. We have black, we have a Latino, we have Asian, we have low income and middle income to higher. And right now, they're getting ready to build a 16-story building at the end of my block. So the community is getting together to make sure that there is going to be low income housing within that structure and that it's not going to be 16 stories. But I do agree that in a community that is starting to get a renaissance, it's important that we have all kinds of people, white, black, you know, all cultures living together. I mean, it can be done. I don't think it should be one, you know, financial, you know, structure in that community.
So do you think that the residents of Clinton Hill are being more successful than some of the other examples that we've heard of coming together, you know, across class and, for that matter, ethnic lines?
Actually, I do. I do. We've had, in the last 6 months, we've had three new businesses, black-owned businesses that have opened up on Myrtle Avenue. And it's definitely changed the makeup of that area, I think for the better. On the other hand, there are low-income people in the area that are being pushed out. I mean, the rents have increased. It's moving further down Myrtle Avenue where low-income housing is being turned into condos, co-ops. So, you know, that still is an issue, but I don't think it is so much an issue as it is in other communities, like, for instance, like Harlem.
Right. Monique, thanks a lot for your call. Professor Patillo, I don't know that you're familiar with Clinton Hill in particular, but any reaction to that?
Well, I actually have very much appreciated the locations of the callers who've called in. I think
we've
one
had
of
Jersey
the things...
City, we've had the Bronx, and now we've
had
Clinton Hill, Brooklyn.
Right. So I think one of the things that the caller Monique ended with is some of the conversions of low-income housing in Clinton Hill. And it sounds like, I mean, it sounds like they have the right, you know, kind of attitude going forward. But it's around the demolition of public housing and the preservation of what are often subsidized through what's called either low-income housing tax credits or through Section 8, project-based Section 8. And I think that's where a lot of activism needs to happen in order to ensure that these neighborhoods do maintain a class mix, a socioeconomic mix, as opposed to completely turning over. Various kinds of subsidies like low-income housing tax credits and Section 8 have time limits. So they're usually either 15 years, perhaps 30 years. And when those contracts expire, they can go condo, they can be for high-income renters, and I think activism around preserving that and preserving public housing, which we are demolishing way too quickly in this country. In Chicago, 20% of the public housing units being demolished in the country are here in Chicago, and that's, I think, a place for activism.
So let me ask you one related policy question on your way out the door, because one way New York is trying to increase affordable housing is to require developers to set aside units in new buildings for below market rates and rents. So the coming formula here is what they call 80-20. Developers of luxury housing are allowed to build larger, taller buildings in many cases for the exchange of making 20% of the units, you know, affordable and subsidized. And I wonder if you think that economically diverse neighborhoods or buildings can be built in this way and function in the interest of the poor.
I definitely think they can be built this way. This is what we call inclusionary zoning. It's been very successful in Montgomery County, Maryland, and they have really been a model for the country. We have a similar proposal in our city council here in Chicago. The mayor has not been supportive as of yet, but I think that there is some traction now that we've recently had some new elections and gotten some new aldermen in there. I think New York is really doing well to have it be an 80-20. Some of these inclusionary zoning bills only include 10% for below market rate, and so I think 20% is quite a positive step, and the developers surely can make money. They do in Montgomery County. And so I think it's really an important step for maintaining an affordable housing stock in these cities where, as we well know, poor people cannot live. Here in Chicago, a person making minimum wage has to work 98 hours a week in order to afford a fair market rent one-bedroom apartment.
Mary Patillo, professor of sociology at Northwestern University, and professor of African American Studies there as well. Her new book is called Black on the Block: The Politics of Race and Class in the City, published by the University of Chicago Press. It's been a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.